Hello and welcome to Manga Splaining, the show where we recommend great manga to folks who haven't read much manga before. Hosted by Debbie Oki, David Brothers, Christopher Woodrow Butcher, and myself, Chip Zdarsky. Follow along with our show notes and reading list at mangasplaining.com. Okay, so most people aren't used to hearing me read the intro, and I don't even know what prompted this, but this is a very special episode of Manga Splaining because we're not looking at manga. We are looking at a North American superhero mainstream garbage book.
I can't believe they still make these things.
I know. Yeah.
Didn't manga kill this yet?
Yeah, come on. Hurry up, manga. This week we're reading Daredevil Born Again. It's the 1987 storyline by Frank Miller and David Mazzucchelli. Near and dear to my heart, not only as a Daredevil reader, but as a Daredevil writer. Yeah, it's my Nausicaa, so I'm assuming what's going to happen is you guys are going to tear into it. And I told myself last night as I was reading it, I was just like, do not let them rile you up. They'll have their critiques. You just got to be cool. You just got to be calm. Don't let it get you personally when Chris does it.
Wait. If this book is criticized, do you actually love it that much that you would take it like hard, do you think?
No. I mean, like, I don't know. I'm a grown up. It's fine.
Are you? Is it?
Sure. I mean, like, so part of the problem is with this book. Well, first of all, let me just read, do what you guys normally do and read the back of the copy that I have just to tell people what it is.
Pro move.
Yeah. Thank you. Karen Page, Matt Murdock's former lover, has traded away the Man Without Fear's secret identity for a drug fix. Okay, there's some problems already. Now, Daredevil must find strength as the kingpin of crime wastes no time taking him down as low as a human can get. So like I said, this is kind of an important book to me. I think it's a gorgeous book because of David Mazzucchelli's art. And hit me just kind of at the right moment as a young reader. And I quite love it. But I noticed, like, even as I was reading it last night, like, I there were so many lines in this that I'm just like, oh my God, like it. The lines hit me so hard again and again over the years, and I've either weaved them into my writing or I just think about them a lot. And like I would get emotional just at certain panels, and for the most part, it's the layouts and the drawings that kind of get me over and over again, because I think Mazzucchelli is kind of a master of his craft. But yeah, it's a very important book to me. It means a lot. It means the world to me. So Chris, what'd you think of it?
Wow, you're right to me, eh?
No mercy.
First off, I have to apologize to friend Jason as a party, as we call him, because he actually bought me a copy of this book when I was still working at the Beguiling, just after he had left. He went, I can't believe you never read Born Again. This is my favorite book of all time. Like, it's my favorite superhero book of all time. You got to read it. He bought me a copy, or maybe lent me his copy. And this is the first time I read Daredevil Born Again.
Seriously?
For this podcast, yeah.
Oh, wow.
I had read the issue with... are we doing spoilers? This is a very old book. This is like,
it's a very old book. We can spoil the hell out of it, yeah.
All right. So I had read the issue because he's like, this issue is the best issue of all of Born Again. I had read the issue where Daredevil's ex, now Foggy's girlfriend, and Ben Urich are in the jail cell. Mm-hmm. And she's photographing the cops turning on them in real time. Mm-hmm. And he's like, look at the economy and look at the panel transitions look at the, like, how the pages are used to maximum effect and look at what it's doing and the emotions on the characters' faces. And I was like, yeah, this all works. Like, it's comics. I had read thousands of comics by that point.
yeah.
So I got that it was well done, but I hadn't started at the beginning, honestly.
Yeah.
And so the... I appreciated it on a technical level, but it didn't grab me. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean, Daredevil was sitting literally on the shelf in front of the cash desk and then in my home for the better part of 15 years of Beguiling times. I never read it. And I regret not having read it earlier, actually.
Yeah.
I think it's a fascinating book and very well done, mm-hmm. but I've read a lot of Daredevil that came after this. that mm-hmm. has incorporated like Kevin Smith's whole run, the whole Kevin Smith, Joe Quesada saves the Marvel Universe run of Daredevil.
Yeah.
I read first because I was reading literally every new comic that was coming out at the time, which is maybe why I'm a little burnt out. And it's hard. It's hard. And we've encountered this with a lot of the classic manga, I think, that you've read, where you're like, oh, I see what they're doing here. But we've also read people who've incorporated every single trick and not trick, but like innovation into their manga, like from the 60s into their manga now. And so it reads a little older, a little clunky. And we keep talking about how it's like Kirby, I think, when we talk about classic manga. But classic manga 40 years ago is 1987. Like it's mm-hmm. it's Daredevil Born Again. Yeah. So I thought that that was interesting. But really, I'm going to save my actual criticism of the book for when we get to Chip's Color Corner.
Wow.
So I can't wait for that segment. Can't wait for that segment this week. It's going to be a good one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that's what I thought.
It's always a surprise on this podcast.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Deb, have you read it before?
I remember reading it a long time ago. Because I think I stopped reading Daredevil around the Electric era.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And I think maybe I had read this one. Because at the time, like, you know, I thought Frank Miller's comics, the Dark Knight ones and stuff like that. And Mazzucchelli's, like, Batman Year One, I really liked a lot.
Mm.
And so, you know, like, this is two great tastes that taste great together kind of thing.
Yeah.
Theoretically. But this was the first time I've read it in years.
Okay, so yeah.
It was like reading it all over again, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, fresh eyes. Mm-hmm. What did you think of it this time around?
I think I've been reading too much manga because my initial reaction was, too much words, too much bright colors.
it's a lot of words. I think it's more words than are in comics now, I think.
Oh, is that
like
right?
Like the use of narration in this is something that isn't done really in kind of the North American Marvel DC books, at least not to this extent. Yeah, I was surprised at the number of words actually on this reread. And it's incorporated well. Like Mazzucchelli understands layout, so he clearly thinks about where the lettering is going to go, unlike a lot of kind of modern comic artists. But it reads a lot like, I mean, Miller of the period and Miller after the period, frankly, it's hard boiled detective prose. It's purple prose. It's very, you know, you can see the kind of the seeds of Sin City in this, the way he describes the setting and the characters and the feelings. Yeah, yeah, it's a lot of words. It's very dense.
There's even a few Sin City names in here, which I thought was
kind of funny. Oh, is that right? Yeah. Wow.
So yeah, besides
I'm going to forget it if I don't mention it, I'm going to forget it. But Ben Urich's wife is named Betsy, but also Nuke's gun is named Betsy, and that just seemed lazy to me.
yeah, that's an editor that didn't catch it. It's funny, even looking at the edition I've got now, I'm like, oh, there are a few like mistakes in here that they just haven't bothered to correct over, you know, decades of reprinting, which is kind of more about the production side, I think. But yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. So even with all the words, did you enjoy it? How did it hit you?
I mean, I think if I boiled it down to like the premise, mm-hmm. you know, like, oh, it's the hero being reduced down to zero and having to, you know, get back to his essence and claw his way back to a sense of normalcy, you know, that all the things that he had that made him, that gave him, like, you know, kind of that a Bruce Wayne kind of thing, right? Where he's rich, he's a lawyer, he lives in a nice place. So he gets to do his heroing, but, you know, he gets to come home, heat a cup of coffee, and sleep in a nice bed that doesn't smell like rats.
That's there before, right?
The small things.
That, and then, like, you know, then you kind of have to, then the other part about, like, being betrayed by someone he used to love, but not knowing that. And then the way that a rich person, like the Kingpin, can kind of unravel his life so quickly.
Yeah.
You know, those kind of things I thought were good. I think what kind of started to lose me was the part when they bring in the psychopath with the American flag on his head.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very Miller thing, for sure. And in my rereading, I was just like, oh, yeah, I don't know. It felt like two separate stories.
Yeah, like it didn't feel necessary.
Yeah, yeah. I felt like he needed to ramp it up. But what I appreciated about the introduction of that character, Nuke, besides just like, the character itself. I actually quite like the character, like him constantly saying our boys, and taking those pills. Like, it's such a funny, it's a funny perversion of the Captain America idea. Mm-hmm. What I liked about the introduction of him is that, I think a normal superhero story by the end would be Daredevil punching the Kingpin.
Yeah.
And he doesn't. Like they have their encounter early on in what is probably one of my favorite fight scenes in comics. Mm. Like when Kingpin's working out and Matt Murdock shows up having lost his mind, and like they go at it, and the way the action's depicted and like the motion of the bodies and Matt's jacket, like it's gorgeous, and he just gets the shit kicked out of him. And that's it. That's it. That's that's his only face to face with the Kingpin. They don't exchange words. Really, like, it's just like that one fight by issue two, and then that's not part of the story because Kingpin is more than that. He's bigger. Mm. So bringing Nuke in was just like, okay, you need the big kind of superhero fight toward the end, and Nuke becomes kind of this weird, almost sympathetic figure by the end, as he's kind of dying in the back of the cab as Matt's kind of driving him ostensibly to a hospital, and then he decides to bring him to Ben Urich because this is the story and this is what kind of breaks it.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's ludicrous. I mean, he's absolutely an invention of the time. Like, nothing sums up 1980s, kind of Reagan era, than this guy with this Rambo with like a flag painted on his face popping pills. Like, even Dash is, it's comic booky, but it's just so fun and stupid. Like, like, give me a red, give me a blue, give me a white. Like, each pill like ramps him up or takes him down. The white takes him down. The red's too much. Like,
is that what it is? Oh,
yeah. Once you kind of like realize what the colors mean, you're just like, oh, of course. Like, it's all, yeah. He's such a funny character, and like, you know, it becomes very dense by the end. There's a lot happening. When's it kind of loop in Captain America? It's like, it's not necessary, but it's just so fun. Mm-hmm. And he's drawn so well.
Disagree.
Is that fun?
No, because you need Captain America at the end.
Yeah. It's not, I mean, you could have done the story without him, because you can just mention him or whatever, but to have Cap there and have his sadness at seeing Nuke, like I love it. Don't get me wrong. Like, it's amazing. And there's so much going on just in that last couple of issues between all the supporting cast, that throwing in Captain America as well was just like, okay, it still works. Don't get me wrong. It still works. And there's some really beautiful scenes. And like, you know, one of my favorite bits still, it's just that one single quiet panel of Captain America on the rooftop and Daredevil as Matt Murdock just leaping off doing this like swimmer's dive. and Captain America says he wears the flag, and Daredevil says, I hadn't noticed. Because of course he doesn't notice, but also for Captain America, like, it just sums him up and sums up how he sees the world seeing America. Mm. Like, of course he didn't notice. You know, he doesn't know Daredevil's blind.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
like there's, and it's so funny just to see, like, it's like one panel and it just sticks out and works on so many levels. Like, I think that's the thing I love about this book, especially on the rereads, is like, I'll find these individual panels. I'm just like, oh, you could dig in on specific panels in here. It's so dense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it also, I don't know, I feel like I'm just going to talk about this book forever, but I'll let David go before I keep going. David, I'm assuming you've read this before.
Yeah.
Yeah. How long has it been since you'd read it?
Probably just a couple of years. I first read it in college. Like, Frank Miller is one of my most like influential, impactful, whatever comics creators. Like, I read Sin City as a teen, and it ruined my life. Like, there's like before and after. It's like Sin City and Jurassic Park are my two signposts.
Wow.
Yeah, it shows in all the movies I watch and the different things that, you know, the models I build and whatnot. Hmm. So I didn't read Miller on Daredevil until I graduated high school. And I came to this kind of in the middle of reading. Like, Marvel did those three Visionaries trades of his whole run. Like, him, Jansen. And I was like, oh, this guy is also good at superhero comics. Who knew? I just missed his 80s entirely. And I loved it the first time, and I loved it this most recent time too. Like you said, Mazzucchelli is incredibly talented. And continuing the manga-splaining trend, I read the Artisan edition.
Yes,
nice.
Oh, nice.
Oh, I wish I read that, because I would want to see this in black and white.
Yeah,
I've got the oversized version of that. I've got like that full IDW like.
Yeah, they've got like a, I forget what they call it. But anyway, there's a big one and a small one. I got the Artisan edition. I'm sorry, is the small one. It's actually readable. And what Chip was saying about zooming in on the panels is totally true, because I feel like no one really draws comics like Mazzucchelli did back then.
No.
Like, you'd think there'd be like a legion of imitators, or at least kind of like in that lane. But really, like, nobody, as near as I can remember, or as near as I can identify.
No. I mean, his gesture is kind of, it's realistic and cartoony at the same time. Like, he pulls it off so well. And there's plenty of detail in here, but he knows where to put it, which most artists don't. Mm-hmm. Like, he gives you just enough to really kind of like get a sense of where people are at and the feeling. He doesn't overdo it, but he can also get away with just showing a car on a street, but you don't see the street, you don't see the sidewalk, you don't see anything, you just see the car.
Yeah.
But like, he can still kind of get away with it because he's just that good. And the one thing I'd notice, especially rereading this and looking at the black and white version, is he was on Daredevil before this, Mazzucchelli, and he wasn't teamed with Miller. I forget, it was Denny O'Neill maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And those issues are fine. They're okay. Like, he's imitating a previous Daredevil artist, Gene Colan, who is really known for kind of his wild kind of gestural anatomy, his intense mood. And so the interesting thing with this is you can see that in the first issue in this. You can see he's not quite there. Well, one of the startling things about this book, and especially rereading it, looking at the black and white edition, is you can see him get better issue to issue. Like, issue one in this is fine. It's very good superhero comics. He understands layout, all the essentials. Issue two ramps up. Like, you can already see that he's getting better. And then by the end, you can see, like, stylistically, he's more interesting. He's taking more chances with his layouts.
But his rendering as well.
Yeah.
His rendering, his technique, the stuff he's putting on the page, like, there's zip tone and all kinds of other effects.
Yeah.
And like the later issues that, man, really work. Like, it's almost like when that issue opens and Karen's in Mexico with the drug dealer that ends up, you know, getting her to New York, and it's all done in zip tone. It's like it's like he woke up. He's just like, oh, I know exactly what this book is now, and I'm good. And we're going to just blow it out of the water from here on. And it has the added benefit of being the only pages in the book that the colorists couldn't ruin. So that's
well, hey, let's get to that then. So Chip's color corner. I cede the floor to Chris for Chris's color corner.
I have a lot of questions about this because I actually really dug in. But David, I'm curious about this more than anything. Did it hit the same way for you now that it did, you know, the last couple times you read it?
No, the lack of color, actually. There's a lot of storytelling that's done through color, or like aesthetic is delivered through color in this book. And it's not there at all in the Artisan Edition. It's more of like, they might have like an overlay or two, but it's not like a cityscape that's like bright pink in the background, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, through the window. That's all done with like a knockout. Like, that's something that a lot of Marvel artists were not doing at the time.
Mm-hmm. A page like this is a page with one of my favorites in the series, J. Jonah Jameson, kind of drilling down on Ben Urich, calling him a coward. Just a take you don't really see with J. Jonah Jameson, like, especially in the Spider-Man comics. Like, in Spider-Man, he's just like a blowhard, but here he's just like, no, this is important what we do. And just the red and the pink is just like so evocative. It's very, very 80s coloring.
The snow, the snow and the blue.
Yeah, these pages were crazy when I saw them with the deliberate negative space, the zip tone.
That's a page, what page? 17.
First page through on the chat for everyone to take a look at. And it's
oh yeah, yeah. God.
Ben finding Foggy in the park for the first time. And it's like, honestly, that black and white page is prettier. I don't even remember. I remember the sequence of events happening, but I don't remember this art from reading the book. But looking at this page here, I'm like, this is gorgeous. And like, knowing exactly how to fade the birch trees into nothing and the negative space that frames Foggy and Ben Urich, like, that's crazy beautiful. And the coloring did not allow me to appreciate it that way. And here's the second one. I just want to do one more because these are going to go on the show.
Oh, yeah,
This is the crashed cab after the King.
Oh, so much better like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like they added yellow to this, like we couldn't tell that it's a cab without yellow. And it's just, I get it. And I know what the audience was, and that's fine. But the coloring choices for this book were not meant to be printed on anything other than newsprint. They weren't meant to be.
Yes.
When it was 100% cyan in the background, or J. Jonah Jameson, 100% red, like a full red in the background, it wasn't going to print like red on white glossy paper. Mm-hmm. It was going to print like solid red on newsprint and be modeled and be like unified by the graying effects of the entire page. And Marvel's coloring ideology for their classic works is just broken. There's no other way to say it. It is garish and ignorant, and I hate it so much. And I don't know what to do about it. Like I actually follow colorists on Facebook bitching about this exact thing with side by sides of scans of comics and scans of books and going, this isn't even the same book anymore. And so reading this and reading it on an iPad where it is not only bright, but illuminated.
Yeah.
Like, that's crazy.
I hate
it. It's not even the same book.
I'm in total agreement. And like to the point where my favorite Daredevil run, this is my favorite Daredevil story. My favorite run is John Romita Jr. and Anna Senti.
Yeah,
it's the same colorist. It's Christy Schiele. I don't know how to pronounce her last name. But it's so much better on paper, like on the original kind of floppy paper, that I refuse to buy the collections. And I've been buying the individual issues. And when I get them all, I'm going to put them into a collection. Like I'm just going to have it made myself, because I think it's the only way to actually kind of represent the work. Because we have one option or the other, which is kind of what the modern publishing industry thinks, which is you do it like this. You just reprint it as is, whatever. Or you go in and you hire a new colorist to do it. And it's usually absolute garbage. Because they're making it super shiny and like trying to modernize it. And it's like, well, no, this is like, this is somebody who understood composition and layout, and it gets ruined almost 100% of the time with any kind of addition of color. One interesting thing in here too is, so Christy did almost all the issues, but there's an issue done in here by Richmond Lewis.
Oh. Mm.
Who's Richmond Lewis?
Richmond Lewis colored Batman Year One and is also David Mazzucchelli's partner or wife. I forget. So that's fascinating to see like how far they came. Because I think they did.
Yeah.
Yeah. R. Lewis did issue two, Purgatory, which has the Kingpin fight, which is actually like all the stuff kind of leading up to it. Like the stuff on the subway train where Matt Murdock's ignoring and the guy's explaining, like, I find that works as comic kind of coloring. Like it's really nice, the blue and the yellow and the purple. And the fight with Kingpin is actually, you know, relatively well done, but it's still not necessary. Like none of it's actually necessary.
I think if you're going to go bold and graphic, you have to know what you're doing. And I actually truly believe that both of the original, kept getting your partner who knows how to color your stuff to come in and set the tone, let's say, with that first book, and then let one of the house colorists take over from there once you've set a style, perfectly makes sense to me.
I don't know what the story was.
Having these like magentics, hard magentas, hard cyans, especially in the 80s, perfectly makes sense to me. Like all gyms in the 80s looked like the Physical video by Olivia Newton-John. It was all hot pink.
Yeah.
So
and I wish that they being still
the
did.
Accent. Well, I live in Taiwan, and my gym is literally a roller disco. Some nights, it's amazing. I'll put a photo in the show notes. But more LEDs in a gym you have never seen. It is fantastic. But yeah, I think it took me 3 issues to stop being actively put off by the color. 3 whole issues.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And then all of a sudden, you get that page, that beautiful atmospheric page of Karen in Mexico, and it's just, oh right, this is what this book is supposed to feel like. Like it's never going to look like what it's supposed to look like, because even getting it out of the bins, that paper's 35 years old now. It's not it's not like what it looked like when you bought it off the racks, but it's what it's supposed to feel like, because the coloring is so minimal and they've just let the original art kind of shine through. So I would love to see this get the same treatment that like Jose Villarubia just recolored Bernie Wrightson's work on Swamp Thing, using the original colors as a guide and recoloring it to look like the original colors do on the page, not like they would look today or not like they've been colored. And I'll throw some side-by-side comparisons. It's breathtaking. Like, oh, this is what you're trying to achieve. Because it's not only like looking at a book and being like, well, what were they going for here? But actually talking to the artist and saying, oh, I was going for this. And it's like, oh, I can do that here like this. And he's like, yeah, perfect. That's great. And I think that this is better than some of the classic reprints I've read from Marvel. And at least the line work holds up, like all the line work's there and it hasn't disintegrated. But it's a real bummer that this is the color edition is the best version of the book. And I think I kind of wish I didn't know that the Artisan Edition existed, actually. And now that I've read this, I'll go back and read it in black and white, because these pages I'm seeing, the black and white pages from the Artisan Edition are just magnificent and look like it almost didn't look like David Mazzucchelli. Sorry, I've been going on.
No. Yeah, no, I agree. Like I flip through my artist edition more than I flip through the color edition now, for sure. I'm finding new things every time I do it as well. Mm. Techniques and like weird little bits. You know, I think I've mentioned before that for the longest time, my lock screen on my phone was this panel of Ben Urich from page 139. Which, as far as I'm concerned, is just like a perfect drawing. It's so good. But when you get in close, his eyes are spirals, which is a thing that disappeared like in the original printing, like on newsprint. But Mazzucchelli just gets in there and just like, oh yeah, like just that frantic feeling.
All the light in that is from the colorist too, like on his eyes. Yeah, that's pretty interesting.
Ben Urich as a character through this, I love. It was my first introduction to him. And, you know, he's got a similar arc to Matt Murdock throughout, where he's kind of beaten down and he has to kind of rise back up. But he's also stylistically the character that Mazzucchelli clearly loves to draw the most, because he's trying all his new techniques on him to kind of get across the idea of like the frozen feeling. Like when he's on the phone in the newsroom, which I just absolutely love. Well,
his bosses are arguing.
Yeah.
He's getting the phone call.
Yeah, you show that feeling of the newsroom, the bustling newsroom, and he's centered and you know, the camera or whatever, the viewer is going closer and closer on him and he's becoming more abstract. Like I think it's like page 90, 91. The use of wide panels and tall panels in this is really fascinating to me because it's hard to do well. And I work with a lot of artists that, you know, attempt it and sometimes drop the ball. The cutting between scenes is so evocative. And the feeling of Ben Urich, like you can feel it as the reader, like it's so intense. And he gets even more abstract after that. They kind of reuse that feeling just a couple of pages later where he's just sitting there and he looks like what David Mazzucchelli ends up becoming with Rubber Blankets, like his follow up to all the superhero work. God, even just the panel above of like the guy being strangled is so well done. Like I can't even get my head around.
Oh, that's weird. That's a reproduction. That's a stat.
Yeah.
That exact panel, the guy being strangled, is from the... I'm looking at that page in another window. I think it's interesting.
Yeah, because there's a lot. I mean, he does that a lot with Ben Urich, where he goes back to scenes, and there were scenes originally colored normally, and now they're all colored red. Like, they're just like, they're imprinted in his mind as these, like, dramatic moments.
That scene is one, Ben Urich on the phone, that I think loses a bit without the color. Like, it's funny that Christopher is so angry about the color, because I've only ever known the glossy version. I read it in a trade paperback first in like 2003 or 2004 or something like that. So it's kind of always looked like this to me. So the revelation of the black and white edition is almost how many different techniques that Mazzucchelli is using. Like Chip was saying, just that one page of Urich, it's almost like he's from a different comic compared to everyone else. You know, like his face is so slim, like the inking is so chunky.
It's so good. You know, in a lot of ways, this is like still just like, it's a very raw work of like two comic creators trying to figure themselves out. Like they're both in their 20s. Mm-hmm. One thing, when I started to write Daredevil, before I started, I gave this a reread. And one of the things I noticed was in the beginning, the narration changes. Oh. Like it starts off as like an omnipresent narrator describing Matt Murdock. Like when he wakes up and stuff. And then just like almost like in mid caption, it changes to him talking.
Yeah, that's what's confusing for me.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, I didn't notice it before because it's just like, this is a writer just like this writing, just like, ah, yeah. And then it feels like this and it feels like that. So there's like, there's awkward bits like that, which are just a sign of somebody just like starting out in a lot of ways.
I bet that would just be colored captions nowadays, you know?
Yeah.
They have like a little logo, like a K for the kingpin.
Of who's talking, yeah.
The Ben text seems to have serifs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like more like a typewriter type of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. They go back between different kind of monologues. Mm-hmm. But I was just more interested in the fact that it went from an omniscient narrator and then in the same captions turned into him like, oh, I got to have a coffee. Like,
yeah.
Like, so there's weird bits like that. But also, like, even within that first chapter, there's like what I find just to be kind of masterful storytelling bits to kind of keep things going. Like, so much happens in that first issue, even though he's not really Daredevil doing Daredevil things.
Mm-hmm.
Like by page 4 or whatever, like his girlfriend's breaking up with him on a recording while he's finding out that like he's being audited by the IRS. Like Miller was really good at kind of overlaying things to kind of keep things going. I think a modern writer would do those as two different scenes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Maybe three.
Maybe three. And another thing I really noticed on my reread before I started writing Daredevil, which I tried to incorporate, especially in early issues, is manga and kind of modern North American comics, a scene changes on a new page. Mm-hmm. That's just how it goes, unless there's some kind of dramatic reason to not do that. Here, the scenes change mid-page constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And not just in terms of like kind of going back and forth between, you know, two characters talking, but like you really notice going through this, the speed of the story because of the fact that he is willing to basically start a new scene halfway through a page. Like there's no time to waste. We're bouncing back and forth between characters and it's so rapid. And like, I found that to be an interesting lesson that I kind of incorporated into some of my Daredevil comics, just to kind of lend some more urgency to the scenes and to throw the reader off just a little bit, like, oh, where are we now? Holy, like, yeah, it's such a juggling act in this book because there are a lot of characters and a lot of scenes, and he's going back and forth at such a rapid pace and trying to like tie it all together.
I'd like to see a chart of all the plot lines and how long they last and when they interact and when they start and end. Because Miller was one of the first guys in American comics to kind of embrace decompressed storytelling. Like, he learned it from...
This is decompressed?
It's not decompressed the way we would use it now, but compared to, like, other 80s books, it's decompressed.
Yeah, I mean, those are the pages where I was gravitating towards, where it's like, just let the fighting happen. You don't need to narrate every single... Like, it's like, I want to watch the boxing match, and I don't need to hear someone say, and then he's throwing this, and then he's doing this, and then he's doing this. It's like, no, just give the artist space to draw the action.
It's strongest, yeah.
There's definitely a lot of Stan Lee kind of thrown into this, where Stan Lee would always just kind of describe the thing that Kirby was drawing. But I think Miller kind of leans into it more with Daredevil because Daredevil's a character is about sensory stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So as a lot of the description I found in this was just like
the internal monologue of characters that isn't necessarily about the action. It's like you were saying, he finds that he's getting audited. He's hearing from his girlfriend that he's getting broken up with. There might be a caption saying a third thing. That does feel very dense storytelling wise, especially coming from manga, but it's more like economical rather than density, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, there's also a poetry when you're writing Daredevil because he's, especially if he's narrating, because he's taking things in a different way than most people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm just, I've got a random page open and it's just like, it's Nuke jumping off a helicopter. And the description is like, low, too near to the street, the motor roaring, dust and dirt, blowing garbage, coughing, startled gas, angry shout, something human, hisses. And then it's like,
mm-mm.
I mean, that's pure Matt Murdock. That's not a narrator describing a thing. That's just like, you're reading it and hearing it through Matt Murdock's senses.
Is that Matt Murdock and Daredevil, or is that what Frank Miller did for Matt Murdock and Daredevil, and now everybody has to do that for every issue afterwards?
It's true. He fully leaned into it and he blew it up. I mean, there were writers before him definitely kind of did descriptions based on his senses, but nowhere near what Miller did. Like Miller, yeah. Miller also kind of came to it from a resident New Yorker standpoint too. Like he was describing the city a lot of the time, and it was the city he was living in and working in during this period. And Nocenti, who followed him on this, did the same because she was also a New Yorker.
That's not necessarily true. Why Steve Ditko followed him for two issues, and
those are two very weird issues. They're very weird issues.
I was reading this on the Marvel Unlimited app, and it's like you read to the end, and I'm like, well, how do they follow that up? And it's like two of the most random issues with Steve Ditko drawing Madcap, the indestructible, you know, like anti-hero. And then Ann Nocenti starts, and that's just like, and Barry Windsor Smith is drawing the first issue of the Ann Nocenti. And it's like, if you want an artist that's as close to Mazzucchelli as you could get probably at that time, it's probably Barry Windsor Smith. But even then, that book looks nothing like the artwork in this book. No. That is wild.
That's a Daredevil hallmark, I think, is having the, like a lot of runs are defined by their writer, but like the artists really carry it. Like Alex Maleev, John Romita Jr. I mean, Frank Miller's art carrying Frank Miller's writing is another good example.
Yeah. I've said that a lot, especially publicly, just to kind of like push Marvel more towards kind of maintaining creative teams, because Daredevil is a consistently successful title for them starting from this period. There are a few kind of aberrations, but a lot of times those aberrations are because you can't name the artist. You can name the writer, but you can't name the artist. But as soon as you get like writer artist teams and maintain those, then those books sell for Marvel forever. They become hits.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Miller, Mazzucchelli, Nocenti, John Romita Jr., Wade Brubaker, and Samnee, Brubaker, Baker, Lark, Bendis, Maleev. And, you know, I'll a bit more of a humble brag, but like me and Marco, like Marco stuck around, even though he was offered many books to go to internally by other editors. But he understood. He's like, no, this is special. And like, you want to be, if you're on Daredevil, you want to be a team. And that's the only way I think you get remembered on that book is if you understand that it's a writer and an artist kind of creating something together. And, you know, you'll have fill-ins and stuff. Romita Jr. had fill-ins, like Marco and I had fill-ins, but maintaining that team is so important.
I wanted to ask too, because Frank Miller is both an artist and a writer, did he do like the roughs, like the storyboards for like how he wanted, or he just said, here's just a script, here's written script, lay it out however you want?
I think he trusted Mazzucchelli. There are some interesting, like I did notice some of the kind of layouts feel Miller-y. From his Daredevil run, because he did do a lot of tall, thin panels. And throughout here, there's a lot of those, which you don't see kind of in modern comics. But I think he knew pretty quickly that he could trust Mazzucchelli to do, frankly, a better job than he could on it.
Yeah.
And like, a writer who can draw just works better with an artist. Like you, the scripts you write are actionable. Like you can actually pull them off. And I know a lot of artists that complain about writers who like they get a script and you're like, well, how am I supposed to do this? Like they haven't thought it through visually. So Miller obviously thinks visually, Mazzucchelli can elevate it like amazingly so. And also, you know, there's interesting stories about this too, where I was like, where Mazzucchelli was like behind, like the Marvel deadlines are kind of wild. So at the beginning of the third issue here, the 229 Pariah, It's like a four page scene where it's just that close up of Matt Murdock as you pull out and all these black panels. that was Miller doing that for Mazzucchelli because he knew he was behind. Yeah. And he's like, this will save you so much time. But it just works so well for the story. Like I especially like, you know, on page 57, it kind of talks about like his memories of first being blinded and like and kind of realizing his new senses, like it's all black and all just his narration. And then just like the largest lettering possible filling the panel and him having to get used to it. And it kind of like starting to recede down the page because that's his first time hearing someone talk to him since he got his heightened senses. Super smart. And like, you wouldn't believe that it was kind of done on the fly just to buy Mazzucchelli some time on his deadline.
Yeah.
There's a lot about this book that I feel that way. like you mentioned, they were younger creators at the time, and I feel like you can really feel it with the script and the captions. Because it feels like Miller doing his crime novel, finally. The one he's been dreaming of since he was like 12 or, you know, whatever. And, but it's mixed with like that Jim Shooter Marvel 80s-ism of being as obvious as you can at all times.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If there is subtlety, it's, you know, it's really kind of buried under the surface.
Yeah. So like, you know, Mazzucchelli does a ton of work in the subtle realm where I think books that are written by Miller but drawn by other people are really fascinating me for that reason. Like Jim Lee on All-Star Batman, there's a version of that book where it looks like Mick Miller's drawings and no one complains about it, but because it's Jim Lee, like, there's expectations that come with such a classic superhero style. And I think with this one, what they touched on or created or something like that is like Mazzucchelli brings everyone down to Daredevil's level. Like, when Captain America shows up, it's not like leaping out of a Quinjet and, like, you know, like lightning striking everywhere. He's a dude on a building who's yelling really loud.
It's a beautiful combination between Miller and Mazzucchelli, that scene, and that scene gets referenced a lot in comics where the Avengers show up, because Miller understands, like, well, this is Daredevil, it's a street level book, and so when the Avengers show up, the description and the images of them are just like, they are otherworldly.
Like
he talks about, like, Thor, like a god, like bringing down rain, and the hum of Iron Man's suit, like, and like, and Captain America's voice, a voice that could command a god, like, like, it's one page and it's just a few captions, and it's just like, oh wow, like, this is like a very human look at these characters, which is overdone now, but again, like, at the time, like, you got to remember, this is 87, so this is like 25 years after Daredevil first appeared. In which, you know, it was all kind of like fun, jokey, fighting Stiltman and stuff. And like, Miller really kind of upended it, for better or worse.
Yeah.
You know, comics changed kind of drastically after Miller. But it's just, it's really interesting to see other characters. Like, those brief cameos are just like a lot of people see this as one of the best Captain America stories, even though he's only in it for like maybe a dozen pages.
Yeah. J. Jonah Jameson, too. Like, this is not Peter Parker's Jonah, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
That page about him, like, talking about how this is power, this is 5 million readers that can bring down mayors and despots, like, like, that is not like, Parker, give me pictures of Spider-Man. Like, it's just not. And it's an economical use of the character too, like, even keeping him in shadow, kind of, because you understand the look of Jameson.
Yeah.
Like, he really just, like, you know, that flat top and that cigar and the Hitler stash, like, you don't need to show him, like, bulging eyes, like, yelling at Ben Urich. He's in shadow. He's like, he's cut by all the blinds,
the window shades. Yeah.
Could I say, like, as a manga reader who reads stuff that creators do write and draw from beginning to end, volume 1 to volume 110, complete control over the character and how it's represented and how they act and how they talk. I find this switch of mood that happens a lot in American comics. To be kind of confusing, or it betrays my emotional investment in the character.
I can see that.
It's like, all the, you know, I know this character as being this, having this principles, having this personality, talking this way, caring about certain things, and then as soon as it's a different writer, bam, you know, like, it gets turned upside down, or it gets like, they become more mean, they become more funny, they become more romantic, they become less romantic. It's like, make up your effing mind. Who is this character?
I think it's part of the appeal of the genre for me. Really? When it's done well, I would say, because like, Daredevil, J. Jonah Jameson's like kind of like a newsman, let's say.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and the Peter Parker was kind of more of a tabloid guy. But I can see how those would still be the same person to different people. Like, he would expect a lot out of Ben Urich because he knows that Ben Urich is like a real reporter. Well, Peter Parker's like a college kid with a camera who, you know, takes bad pictures of superheroes.
Oh, I get that. I mean, like, he's talking like journalist to journalist as like, you know, you, I expect more out of you. And that's, it's not completely off. But it's like, even with the, and you, I mean, we're dealing with characters who are being, how do we say, being presented to readers over generations, right?
Yes.
And like, a hero in the 1940s and the need of the audience and the expectations of the audience is different in the 1940s than they are in the 2020s.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? So like you're dealing with this legacy. The only thing that's the same is like the barest principle of what the character is and the outfit.
Yeah, and even that makes
it so hard right now for people like Chip to come on to Daredevil and try and do an iconic run, because every single reader of Daredevil that's left, frankly, has got a different favorite era of Daredevil. And do you decide that you're connecting directly to Frank Miller and skipping everything in between? Or are you picking your favorites and taking those parts and not including the like wacky misadventures of the 1960s Gene Colan stuff? Like, it's no matter what impossible. You do, you're going to piss somebody off.
Yeah, because like the continuity of the characters is so convoluted and so many things have happened to these characters over like dozens and dozens of years that you have to willfully ignore certain things in order for the characters to feel grounded and real.
Yeah.
Like, and then I had a lot of work on Spider-Man because like there are so many Spider-Man stories out there. Like Daredevil, at least there's no Daredevil spinoffs. Like Daredevil's been one title for the past 60 years or whatever. Mm. Whereas Spider-Man has had multiple titles every month, sometimes shipping twice a month. So when I want to write a story on Sandman, his classic villain, and I pull up the Marvel wiki for the character, I'm just like, oh my God, like literally everything's happened to him. He's been good, bad, dead, come back, like evil, like a different person. Mm.
That stick of chewing gum has been chewed so much, there's no more flavor left.
And so you've got to kind of take that and inject it with more flavor, and you have to ignore the fact that it's been chewed so many times. And kind of,
I would say there's another stick in the pack that has flavor, and it, like your new
yeah maybe
is
that's
that
a better way of going about it. But it, no, it's I love so hard.
That.
And
it's
like
actually, it's such a good gross.
And I've often said like if you're writing Spider-Man, it's so hard to have Peter Parker walking down the street talking to Flash Thompson or Betty Brant or any of his secondary characters in a normal way, because they've all undergone so much. Like they should all be in mental hospitals at this point, because they've all died, had their partners murdered, had superpowers, turned into werewolves. So many things have happened to these characters that it's hard to reset it and make it feel like they're just normal people.
Mm-hmm. That feels so frustrating.
It is, but you pick and choose the bits of continuity that help, and you have to kind of ignore the rest. Like, because one of the things with writing a Marvel or a DC comic is, and it's a crutch, is that you have the built-in empathy for a character. Like everyone that's come before you has built up those characters and the emotional investment. It's far easier for me to come on as a Spider-Man writer and hit Aunt May with a bus and have people react to that than it is for me to have just an old lady get hit by a bus. Oh. I haven't done the work. I haven't built up Aunt May anymore, but because all the other creators before me have, it makes it easier to get that kind of cheap emotional response from a reader. So it's interesting. Like you have to challenge yourself and become a better writer in order to kind of navigate all that stuff.
And as a reader, it's a jumping on and jumping off point. Like sometimes it's like just not your thing. Like it's just dumb or fine, you know?
Yeah.
But not the kind of fine that you want. Like Spider-Man, I love. But like the Tom Holland guy, he's not funny enough to be my Spider-Man. Like he doesn't tell jokes. He's in funny situations, and that's different for me.
Yeah.
But the jumping on and jumping off point makes sense to me, because like I've actually seriously checked out of a series I've been reading once the creative team changes.
I think that's good, personally.
That's natural. I find the aberration of someone who stays with the series no matter who's on it, that's a problem.
Really? Yeah.
Because those are the people who are just interested in the characters, and they're always angry. They're furious. And they really are. Like they buy it every month, even though they've
like
grown
rage
out.
Buy?
Yeah, even though they've grown out of it or it hasn't become their cup of tea. Like like I remember when Dan Slott was writing Amazing Spider-Man, like people were just like, this isn't Spider-Man, blah, 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 blah. Like, but they've been reading it for 10 years. Like Dan was on that title for 10 years. And if in 10 years you think that character's not Spider-Man, like guess what? Like he's the guy writing Spider-Man. It's Spider-Man. I like that kind of that coming and going and having to bring in readers. I was lucky in a sense on Daredevil that, and I notice it a lot more now that I do conventions again. so many people come up to me, mostly I'm noticing like young women who really love the TV show, the Netflix show, and they love Charlie Cox. And so they were like, can I find out more about him? And then they found my book, which isn't a one-to-one comparison. And I didn't consciously go into it thinking, I got to make this feel like the Netflix book to get the Netflix readers. But I kind of, I ignored a lot of like, bigger continuity issues and made it a more grounded, kind of relatable book.
And, but you still brought in Mike Murdoch.
Well, that's the thing. If I can, but I didn't do it right away. Like, if, like, I think you can
made
Elektra
Daredevil.
You can
sell that was your fault? Okay.
The first 20 issues were very basic, like very much, it copied a lot of this book, actually, Born Again, like bringing him down, kind of bringing him back up. And I consciously kind of like kept all those kind of weirder Marvel things away. But I knew as soon as I had them by issue 20, I could start to kind of fold those in and be like, oh, here's something fun and interesting. And let's try something new and go bigger and weirder with it. And that was a conscious decision on my part because I wanted to make sure I could get the new readers in and then kind of introduce them to like the more interesting parts of the Marvel Universe stuff. It's a hard balancing act because you don't want to ostracize old readers. You don't want to turn away new readers. So you have to like, you have to figure out ways to
trick all of them into buying your book.
I mean, the way you're describing it, right, is like, I'm teaching this class at CCA and this week's session was all about doujinshi. I was telling my assignment to the kids, it's like, your midterm is you're going to create a parody comic based on someone else's creations.
Nice.
Like someone else's character, someone else's universe. Do whatever you want with it. 4 pages, go. Like, have fun with it. Like,
amazing.
Put them in a different time. Bring the side characters to the front. Change the ending. Do a prequel. Mash it up. You know, like Simpsons and Akira. What a genius.
Mashup, right? Yeah.
Like, do something crazy. You know, or like the one I have a doujinshi where it's by the guy who did My Dad is the Queen of the VTubers. He did a doujinshi of just what if all the fairy tales characters, fairy tale protagonists, all had giant muscles.
That's
a winner.
Yes, it's like, you know, Little Red Riding Hood and Grandma all have muscles. They beat the shit out of the big bad wolf, right?
Yeah.
and it's like Aladdin has muscles. Woo! And it's like, anyway, it's just story after story of just all the characters. What if they had muscles?
Amazing,
like
amazing.
Giant steroided muscles. So the thing that I like when you're describing this, it basically feels like when you're taking on a Marvel or DC book, you're a doujinshi creator.
You are. I mean, I feel in my heart that Spider-Man ended when Steve Ditko left. At that point, it was no longer Spider-Man. It wasn't. It became a totally different book under John Romita Sr. and Stan Lee. And I think as soon as the original creators leave a thing, it is no longer that character. Like
Dragon Ball Super, you could argue, right? It's not.
Dragon Ball. And people do. They argue that Dragon Ball Super isn't real Dragon Ball. And Dragon Ball, what was the TV show that no one GT. Liked, but now everyone likes? Yeah, GT. Everyone's like, oh, it's not real. But now everyone's like, but it's said in GT that this happened. And like everything's canon, but nothing's canon. And it's all doujinshi.
Yeah, sounds like DC a little bit. Everything's canon, nothing's canon.
And then they have to reboot it all. Then they have to wipe it clean and start again.
Yeah.
The thing with Marvel is they never wiped it clean.
Oh.
Yeah. Like DC, they've wiped it clean in quotes like 4 or 5 times at this point, like reset the universe, new continuities to the point where it's very hard for me writing Batman to know what happened, what didn't. And my previous editor was just like, I don't know if you wanted to happen, it happened. That's kind of our feeling.
Can I'm just like, say, okay. As a manga reader, that's just way too much work for me.
As a manga reader, where you can go back to every single page and be like, this happened because there was no universe wiping situation. That's gotta very be crazy. Tricky. Yeah, like
it's hard to write. Like I just did. Sorry, I feel like this episode's all about me, but I wrote a Batman.
That's the whole point.
I just wrote, and it's just coming out, Batman 3-parter called Joker Year One, where I'm just like, all right, I want to kind of focus on kind of like early Joker days, like how did he become the Joker, blah blah blah, you know, but then I had to be like, okay, well, what happened, and what didn't happen. And it was so hard, and I had to dance between so many weird raindrops because, like, there was a previous writer that kind of redid his first kind of adventure. And then there's another writer recently that kind of redid his first time meeting Batman. And like, so I'm like, oh my God, like to find the spots where I can add to the continuity and play with the continuity was so tricky and so hard. And to tell a good story, because that's the other thing. You can't just be like servicing continuity and servicing fans.
Those are the worst.
I know. And so you have to also tell a story. I'm like, oh, is this a story I want to read? But also that won't piss everyone off or make no sense because X, Y, and Z already happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's tricky. It's really, really tricky. I like the challenge, but yeah.
But there's also like those new manga superhero ones that are coming out that are just like, whoa, that's a crazy twist. Like Doc Octopus as a little girl.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Or
yeah.
Like the Joker taking care of Batman, who's a baby.
Yeah.
Let's follow Superman as he goes and eats all the food in Japan.
Yeah. It's sometimes you got to trust the book. Like it'll give you all the info that you need, I guess.
Like, it's just kind of crazy. Like the Japanese take on these characters. It's like, I've never seen any American writer.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the American company should probably do more of that. Like Marvel and DC, they have their divisions that do books like that. Mm-hmm. DC has Elseworlds. Marvel has What If. And these are supposed to be ostensibly books where anything can happen. It's a different universe. But they play it very safe. And they never really venture into like that kind of comedic territory, which the characters really lend themselves to. I wish they would more. And, you know, I'm partly at fault, too, because I haven't pitched them on any of it. But also, it's so hard because the North American superhero reader doesn't want comedy anymore.
Oh, yeah. They have no sense of humor anymore, do they?
No, it's very hard. And you know, it's also the fact that comedy is so subjective. Like, as a writer, I could probably make 8 out of 10 readers cry in a story. Like, I can weave it in such a way that, like, oh, by the end, you're just like, oh, my God, like, Spider-Man's a good guy. But I could maybe make 2 or 3 of them laugh because comedy is so subjective. The deeper emotions of like pain and suffering, loss, like these are things we all relate to on like a basic level. And it's relatively easy to like evoke that in a reader. Mm. But jokes, comedy, I mean, like it's hard.
I remember Keith Giffen's run, right? Like he used to do that, put a piss on it.
Justice League.
Yeah.
Is that out of fashion now?
It's out of fashion. And the market's so narrow that I think it's really hard to like, to have the numbers to support a thing. Like, I think everyone that really likes that kind of brand of humor will just keep buying it, but there's just not enough people that like a specific brand of humor that'll keep buying a thing. Yeah. Lobo was another case. Yeah. I love Lobo when I was a teenager.
I want to go all the way back to Way of the House Husband, because I would actually argue that the things that make superhero comics in the art and storytelling department, like the things that make them superhero comics, are maybe antithetical to the kind of humorous comic book storytelling styles that we see in manga, like City or like Way of the House Husband, or like having a like hard reaction shot, having an over the top, like a hard pause before reaction, having an over top reaction, having a character staring blankly and not understanding what the other one's saying with like dot, dot, dots, that simplicity of drawing or economy of line that allows you to project yourself into either of the situations. That's not what superhero comics are. Superhero comics are realistically rendered drawings on a page that happen in real time.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's like, I don't think humor is impossible at all. I think you could do, people have done it and people have made it work. Yeah. The, you know, Giffen DeMatteis, just one punch Guy Gardner situation is a perfect example of comic timing that still obeys all the comic book superhero rules.
Yeah.
But it still comes down to punching a guy, which is a little bit superhero-y. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I was going to say like the catch is to blend the two together. Hawkeye did it well as well.
Yeah.
Fraction and David Aja. Yeah. But they also, there was like a lot of heart to it and there's stakes and drama and stuff. And Justice League was the same. Like I often say like introducing humor and levity to a superhero comic just makes the tension in like dramatic scenes more dramatic and more tense. Like I was almost scarred. I mean, I was in high school and I was reading Justice League and there was like an issue after all the jokes where like this alien monster just like murders like a character's family and like just is destroying a town and kills everyone in the Justice League. And like Adam Hughes drew it and it was gorgeous. And I was just like, what a left turn, but it hit me far more than if I was reading a comic where that happened every month.
Yeah. I thought one of those was Spider-Man. Oh, like, yeah. One of my favorite Spider-Man story arcs is actually during the Clone Saga, or maybe just after. It was building up to the Clone Saga, because, like, his parents were around, and they were spies, that kind of thing.
Sure, yeah.
But anyway, like, Spider-Man basically has a nervous breakdown, and it's like, I'm going to be a serious superhero from now on. Like, I'm going to, you know, beat people half to death. The usual grim and gritty 90s thing. Mm-hmm. But it was such a stark change from how he'd been my entire life up to that point, where he's, like, kind of, he might be sad or melancholy, but he's still kind of the funny guy. Like, he's got a positive outlook. This was like, oh, no, this is depression, and maybe also a nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
Which in hindsight, maybe it was riffing on Born Again a little bit. Like, there's like some texture in there that's kind of interesting.
And they've done that with Spider-Man a few times. Like, like just the moments where that character becomes serious, he becomes like the most dangerous character that Marvel has.
Yeah.
And it's always shocking, and it works. And like when I was writing Daredevil, I had him show up as a cameo basically at the end of the first arc, where he shows up and he basically tells Daredevil, you're done.
Yeah.
Like, take the costume off, you're done. Like, he's gone too far. And like, that was an instance where I used Miller, because I had Daredevil describe him just of like coiled power. Like, he's just like, if you break down Spider-Man as like a superhero, powerful character, he's like, he's the most powerful. You can't lay a punch on him. He can throw trucks at you. Like, and it presented Spider-Man in a bit of a scary way, just for like a few panels.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked because he's not normally that.
Yeah.
You can only go to that well once in a while with that kind of character. And it hit, like, I don't know, like most people when they come up to me at a show to talk about Daredevil, like they mention that scene, like that it's chilling and it's cool, and it, you know, some of them say respect Spider-Man, which is not the point of the scene, which is a phrase I hate when people say that to me. I'm like, I don't respect Spider-Man. I fucking write him.
I keep thinking he's, respect not Wood from Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah, exactly.
Respect
but Wood. I think Born Again works kind of in the reverse, because there's so little Daredevil in this Daredevil comic. Mm. Like, I think when he finally puts the costume on, it's to beat up someone dressed as him.
Yeah.
Or rather, when the costume finally shows up, it's to beat up the doppelganger, you know?
Yeah. And like, we get like one of the only fast pages is, you know, it's awesome. Like, cause you go from this page and you know, it's coming, you know, like you got the panels where it's like, boom, boom, you know, the baton is like hitting things and the hand grabs it. And like, you know, Nuke is like, give me a red, like chilling, perfect panel. And then you got that. And then you got like one of the most classic kind of Daredevil drawings of all time.
It's like one of the most iconic drawings. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, it has impact because he hasn't been around for several issues, which is such a rarity back then. Cause you got to remember Marvel in the 80s, Jim Shooter, he had a 2-issue limit on your storyline. He was like, this is during the period where he was like, you know, you can have a cliffhanger, but you can wrap it up in the next issue.
Oh,
that's
interesting.
It. Like, and it's smart from a business point. If you're going for kids, like you don't want stories to go on too long. You want to be able to pick it up and get your full story in one issue, maybe two. So this was like quite an exception. And like, I remember as a kid, so like, remember those, you go to department stores or whatever, and you get like the 3 packs of comics.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where
yeah.
just be like, you could see the two and you knew there was a shitty one in the middle, but you bought it anyways.
Ouch.
And I bought the one issue two here with, you know, with the Murdoch on the cover. That was one of them. And I remember as a kid reading this and just being like, what is going on? Like, he's lost his mind. He's not Daredevil. He goes to see the Kingpin. The Kingpin beats him up and he ends up in the bottom of a river. Like, it was the most intense thing I'd ever seen in my life. And it was not reflective of the books I was reading at the time, which was like Marvel Superhero Secret Wars, you know, or Spider-Man. They were really trying something new with this book. And the beauty of Daredevil as a title is that writers and artists can come on and try something new.
Yeah.
Like there's the freedom there, because the character doesn't tie into anything else. He's not an Avenger. He's not an X-Men. He's not in the Fantastic Four. He's not cosmic. I know he popped into Avengers during Bendis's run, but like,
he didn't mean it.
But as a rule, the title stands on its own.
Mm.
Like, I had him not in costume for like 12 issues, maybe.
Mm.
Like, I was telling a different story, and if I was working on Spider-Man, they would not let me do that. I don't think I could do a single issue without him in costume, because it's the flagship title. It represents Marvel, but Daredevil's like, go do what you want to do. You're telling a story about him having anxiety attacks? Great. Like, enjoy. Yeah, so it's a special title, and it's because of this run and Miller's solo run before it that everyone's been kind of afforded the luxury of telling the story they want to tell.
Well, I want to throw something out there because you've written both, but everyone kind of, you know, like sometimes the Marvel DC kind of have like their analogous characters, right? Mm-hmm. Batman and Daredevil seem to be analogous. Like they are street level. They are ostensibly well-to-do men in respectable lives who have a secret life.
Yeah. I find them to be very different characters because Daredevil is weak and he's full of guilt. And there's Batman as a character. Batman puts on the Bruce Wayne persona and he's like really, he's Batman, you know? Whereas Daredevil, he's all duality. He is a Catholic who dresses as the devil. He's a lawyer who beats people up at night. He feels intense guilt in the face of God. Like, he's a mess. He's an absolute mess. He's unsure of himself.
He stops a robbery in this book to steal money, to steal $30,000 to rebuild a diner that gets destroyed.
Yeah.
He's just like, yeah, taking it from the kingpin doesn't count. And it's just like, yeah, Batman's not doing that.
Batman is 100% sure of himself at all times. Daredevil is never sure of himself. Like,
oh, interesting.
I think fundamentally they're different, even though they are two white men with stubble on a gargoyle in the rain. Mm-hmm. Like there is that basic level, and Batman, even when you take his money away, he's always rich. Like at the end of this series, Daredevil works in that diner. Like Daredevil has kind of ups and downs in terms of his kind of personal life and his financial setting. Like the Andacenti run, he basically worked at a free clinic giving legal advice to low income people in New York, and it's the best setting for that character.
Yeah.
Yeah, the high-powered lawyer stuff almost rarely kind of shows up in the comic. You know, I think David made a joke. What was it in the Slack about?
Oh, that nowadays Kingpin would blow up Daredevil's studio apartment instead of his brownstone.
Oh, New York.
I know. Yeah, this is New York in the 80s. Matt Murdock could afford a building. Anyone could afford a building, but but no, he definitely can't.
You know, like, I want to throw in something before I forget, but that I find that the sound effects in this comic to be very boring.
Boring? Mm,
yeah, yeah.
They use the same font for whether the building's exploding, whether Daredevil is hitting Kingpin on the stomach with a bat, whether there's, like, whether there's honking horns in a street. Same font. Same block font.
Like, do you want more molding and style, like design?
No, more mood. Like if you look at, there's a page where it's like the sea, like a bird is cawing. It's going, caw. Then it's like, oh, Hong Kong, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, it's the same font.
Yeah. Like, even on this page, it's like, building blows up, woom. And the next page, gunfire is bam. And they're almost the same. Like, they haven't really differentiated them enough. You know, this is a case where I think it'd be amazing if Matt Zakelli did the lettering. Right.
Oh, he probably didn't do that.
Huh? No, he did not do the lettering. I don't think so. Like going through the black and white.
No, I think it's Joe Rosen.
It's Joe Rosen. You know, he's a Marvel letterer. So, you know, he's lettering like 30 books a month. Oh. But yeah.
What's funny is I feel like this lettering, what's the most normal way to say this? It sounds like New York City to me, like the flat kind of very squared off shapes, like they're very kind of tall and thin letters. Like there's something about it where I associate it with 80s New York comic books. Maybe it's because they were doing this in Marvel.
Yeah.
Mm. One thing about the lettering and the sound effects is it does a thing that I am not allowed to do anymore, which I'm always trying to do, which is all the scenes of Matt Murdock punching a punching bag. The sound effect is FAP, which in current culture basically means masturbating. But it's the perfect sound. Like it, like if you punch a punching bag, fap, fap, fap. It just makes so much sense. Oh, there you go. So much. And I keep trying to slip it in, and Marvel Legal or whatever circles it every time. Like, change that sound effect, buddy. So my new sound effect is jerk off, jerk off.
I mean, I guess when you first assigned this book, and like I said, I haven't read this one in quite some time, and I knew that it would this was originally printed on newsprint and it looks so much nicer that way. I checked out the first time I opened up this book. Like I was like, holy, so much. I don't know where to look. The color's way too saturated and there's so many tiny, tiny words. And
it's a wild contrast to manga. That took me a bit to get used to on this podcast. Mm. It's just like how everything breathes. At first it felt like too much because used to it, because I'm used to the value for your money on a Marvel comic, it's only 20 pages and it's like $5. It's the fact that you're going to get a lot of words and a lot of detail, a lot of panels on a page. Right. So it's almost closer to reading like a novel, but yeah, manga, obviously everything's like spaced out and breathes a lot more. And it obviously works really well, but it's just such a different style to this. Like I can see how it'd be hard to go kind of back and forth between the two.
It's
almost like a different language.
Almost like a different language. Like modern Marvel comics, like there's more opportunity for beats and pauses and things like that. Mm. But that also makes it feel not worth the money because like you're picking up an issue where like you're just like, what? Nothing happened. And like, oh, sure, there's some really nice emotional things through it, but like the storyline hasn't moved. There isn't one big moment in a 20-page comic that you can look at and be like, oh, yeah, that was interesting. Oh. And also, in every 20 pages, you have to have a fight. So it's
That's what Jim Sub wrote in that recent Twitter thread, right? Where he was saying like he sees people trying to mimic the manga style of story beats. And he said, not recognizing that in American comics, you only have this many pages. And if you don't grab a reader by the end of the first issue, it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You need the cliffhanger at the end of the 20 pages. And like I was saying, like you need a fight scene, you need some sort of action to happen within those 20 pages as well. And you also, like a good writer will give you enough info on the characters as a new reader. So you're not confused as to what these knives are coming out of this man's hand. Like, you know, you don't want to go total Chris Claremont and, you know, describe everyone's powers every issue, but every issue is somebody's first. So it's hard. It's a hard job. I mean, look, I'm not digging ditches or anything. It's not hard work, but it's like, there's a lot of considerations to something like this. And also you have to be aware that you don't own it and somebody else has different ideas as to what the character should be or shouldn't be.
Dang.
So yeah, it's tricky. Yeah. It's very different from manga, but you can see, obviously, I think Mazzucchelli probably read manga based on some of the drawings in here.
Miller definitely did.
Yeah. If Mazzucchelli's copying Miller and Miller's copying manga, then there's something there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How long have we been going? I never normally host one of these, so I don't even know what's...
An hour 17.
Wow.
Beautiful. Probably. Beautiful. All right. Well, and then as hosts, my duty is to wrap this thing up. So yeah. I know that the conversation kind of deviated a lot from the actual material itself, but I enjoyed reading with you and none of you hurt my feelings. So thank you very much. So I guess we'll go final thoughts. I'll start with David.
Yeah, for me, you mentioned your favorite panel earlier was Captain America on the roof. One of my favorite drawings in this book is everything with Glory taking pictures at the end.
Oh yeah,
The gestures are so good, and the one in the interrogation cell when she's kind of leaned back while the cop is shooting almost at her, and she's just like hooked on the camera. Perfect comics.
Perfect comics. Agreed. Yeah. All right, Deb. Final thoughts?
I mean, I can appreciate the innovative storytelling things that he's doing visually. And I think there's a lot of, when I'm looking at the story arc, I think it's really interesting. I just feel like it's so cluttered. too much words.
Too much information on a page.
Well, just like Kingpin, for example, Kingpin cannot shut up in his head.
He's really melodramatic.
He really is. He really is.
I actually skimmed most of that.
Deb. No, I would never skim a manga. Never.
I guess, and then there was like a character in the beginning that he's explaining everything, Kingpin, and he talks in a really florid kind of way.
Oh, like, I love that guy. It's just like so over the top and ludicrous. That really worked because like what he's describing is so violent and basic. Like, I don't know. I know.
It's
super funny to me.
It's a thing. It's a thing. I'll try and check out the black and white version because I do like David Mazzucchelli as an artist, and I think he's a really great cinematic storyteller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't have as strong, warm feelings toward the story as you do.
Nobody can.
But maybe it's kind of like people who, like, I have friends who love Disneyland with a passion.
Mm.
And I do not feel the same way about Disneyland. I could go to Disneyland once or twice and it's cool.
I managed to make it all the way through this podcast without getting angry, but you comparing my love of this book to Disneyland, frankly.
No. I'm saying
the happiest place on earth, Chip. That's a good comparison. I was like,
The metaphor I'm trying to give is that they bonded with this story, with Disneyland, very young, and it means something to them emotionally.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I didn't bond with Disneyland when I was young, for it doesn't have that same resonance. And I think when you're in younger, or like you're in your 20s, like teens and 20s, the stuff you take in at those times are so meaningful and so impactful that it's hard to underestimate that time, right? When you love something so much, and that love of comics that comes in your teens and 20s, chick coming out of the egg and seeing mommy for the first time kind of moment.
Daredevil's my mommy, and I've often said it.
Yeah, like you love it, and it really shaped who you are. Yeah. So I unfortunately don't have that relationship with this book, but I can understand why you do, because I think there's a lot of special things about it.
No, you're forgiven. Chris, your final thoughts?
Holds up. I think it holds up for sure. I do think the current edition of it does it a disservice, the color edition. But I think it's funny because the first edition of Daredevil Born Again didn't have the prelude issue in it with the Gladiator that was co-written by Mazzucchelli. And it was printed on newsprint, actually.
Oh,
it was printed with this coloring, but on newsprint. So it grayed all out a little bit, which was interesting. And I think you could still find that first edition, you know, it doesn't have any value, but it's the one with the good coloring, so it might now. You could probably find it in used bookstores like that. The it doesn't have glossy pages. It's probably a better way to read it than either the app or the color. I want to go back and read the black and white now, but I'll have to wait till I live in a country where I can buy that. And it's also weird, the more we've talked about this, the more I realize I've read every other comic, I think every other comic David Mazzucchelli's ever drawn. I've read everything that Frank Miller did after this, starting with Dark Knight and year one and then Dark Knight, I guess. And then I think everything until I tapped out at All-Star Batman and Robin, thankfully, before we got to the real dredges of his career. But I've never gone backwards from Batman year one and Dark Knight to see this, to see the Spider-Man stuff, to see, you know, the other work that he's done, which I think is really interesting. And my introduction to Daredevil was reading Man Without Fear by John Romita Jr., which is his life story, his Batman year one, his Daredevil year one. But I only picked it up and read it because it tied into the origin of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. If you don't know this, Daredevil and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the same inciting event for their origin story, which is a radioactive canister falling off of a truck. After it blinds Daredevil, it goes down to the sewer, and that's how we got the Turtles. They were big. Speaking of things that this book influenced, that's why there's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, actually, is this book.
Yeah.
Probably should have led with that. Maybe people would have stuck around for an hour and 23 minutes. Oh, and I know it's not shout-outs, but I think when you were talking about Fraction and Aja's Hawkeye run,
yeah,
if I was going to recommend a comic to Deb, a Marvel comic to Deb that's a classic self-contained run, I would have started there. I think it would have really hit with her as something that was funny, and that the storytelling was really not straightforward exactly, not consistent exactly, but a little easier to parse. I feel like there's a rhythm and a grid that is often not Miller and Mazzucchelli, you know, change of panel sizes a lot more, let's say. And the rhythm of pages changes to suit the scene rather than to suit the issue. And so, Deb, if you ever want more comics, more Marvel comics, Hawkeye is where I'd I'd suggest you go by Matt Fraction and David Aja, but nothing before and nothing after.
Wow. All right. I was going to suggest my Howard the Duck, but all right, that's fine.
You're not allowed to self-suggest. Wait, are you? Oh, shit.
Yeah.
I've got a really good manga.
Self-interest.
I got a good pick for after the break. Sorry. Right, and speaking I should of, hand this over to David. Yeah.
I would suggest maybe let's do this once a season. I don't mind.
Yeah. It's pretty fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm in. Cool. That's everyone's final thoughts.
No, I don't know. I don't think David gave final thoughts.
Yeah, David went. Yeah, David went first.
I talked about Glory's photography and how good the gestures were.
Yeah. You did, and it was very good.
Yeah. I want to say that Karen Page is not a great character.
No, no. I meant to talk a bit about that, but that's the unfortunate 1980s effect in this book. Yeah, Karen Page's story as the junky porn star.
Yeah.
Not a fan.
Selling out Matt Murdock for another hit. I'm just like, yeah, we can get into that later. Yeah, so that's it. That's all our final thoughts. This was Daredevil Born Again, and I guess we'll come back with some shout outs in just a moment.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com. This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And we're back. And before shoutouts, we need to pick some books for me to read because I'm craving manga now that I've had to read one of these goddamn Marvel comics with all their words and their colors. So it's book picking. David, you want to go first? What do you got for me?
Yeah. So I had that scheme for picking books this season, where you would choose a number between like one and whatever. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So basically for readers who are just tuning in, listeners who are just tuning in, I've got four categories. I've got funny, which is obvious. I've got David genre, which is like things that I specifically like for my own perfectly good reasons.
David genre.
Left of center, which are things that are a little bit weirder, not quite obvious picks, but still pretty fun. And then like art focused.
Okay, interesting.
Let's see. I've got 1 through 6 in all four of those. So give me a category and a number.
All right. Well, I think because we talked about humor in comics a bit during this, I'm going to go for funny this time.
Okay.
And my number is going to be number 2.
Number 2. Wow. Okay. So
that was really three for a loop there.
You actually chose the only print comic on my list.
Oh, son of a bitch. All right, what is it?
But it's one we've talked about a lot. It is called Shortcuts by Usamaru Furuya. I have such a hard time with his last name.
It's not in digital?
No, there's no digital. I'm pretty sure it's like unlicensed, out of print, but I happen to have an extra copy so that I can mail you.
Oh my God, okay.
You're so mean.
Yeah, but
it's so out of print that when I was getting rid of every book I owned, I'm like, I'm keeping these two, actually. They're going into a box. All right,
you still got it. Deb, do you have a copy?
I think I do.
Deb, you have to have a copy. Worst case, I can let you borrow mine.
I don't have a copy. It's in Toronto. I live in Taiwan.
Oh, no, I mean, Deb will.
Oh, yeah.
This is going to be weird. I don't know what we're going to do.
Yeah.
All right.
What it is essentially a bunch of one-page comics. It's two volumes long. Mm-hmm. Let's read the first volume. It's from Young Sunday Magazine. And each page is a cut, which is a short comic that has like basically one joke that they kind of space out. Right. It's legitimately one of the funniest books I've ever read. Not every strip is a hit, but the ones that are like, you know, tears in your eyes. Kind of a good time.
All right. All right. Good job. Deb, what's your pick?
Wow, it's so hard because we've gone so hard on the male gaze for this first season so far, for this season five, that I almost want to index back to something that's softer.
Sure.
But at the same time, the stuff I want to throw at you, because I just want to throw in something popular so people will go, what did Chip think of that one, huh? So I will say, okay, give you a choice. Mobsters or sports?
Mobsters.
Okay. All right. So we are going to go with The Fable.
Okay.
The Fable is a Kodansha manga. Basically, it's about a guy who is such an amazing assassin, such an amazing hitman. He's a legend in his own time. That's why his codename is The Fable. He is kind of a dead-eyed kind of guy, but he is really good at what he does. He's gotten so good at what he does, his boss tells him, you know what? Time for you to take a little vacation. Lie low for a little bit. Take a year off. Go have some fun. Pick up a new hobby. Move to a new town. But I don't want to hear nothing about you killing nobody, because that would be bad. And so our friend, somehow, though, trouble finds him in very funny ways, because people notice him. And he starts getting people who want to be I want to be your apprentice. And then the guy who tries to be his apprentice just cannot keep up with this guy.
All right.
Anyway, it's freaking hilarious. And it's so funny because, like, the assassin's true passion, he wants to be a graphic designer.
Classic. Classic.
It's a good one.
All right. Sounds good. Chris?
I'm going for some sad dad comics, but in the vein of Jiro Taniguchi, you know, sad letters from my father who was cheating on my mom at the time, we're going to go a different direction.
Is that what that was called?
And it's... Yeah, that's what that was called. And it's by Taiyo Matsumoto, because he's entered his sad dad years. And we liked everything we've read of him. We read Tech on Kinkreet. We read Ping Pong. And I'm going to pick the new one that just came out, because I want to read it for myself. It's called Tokyo These Days. And for those of you who are listening, you might realize that we actually published the draft version of this story on Mugsplaining History. It was called These Days. And it was supposed to originally run in like a magazine rather than in a manga magazine. And he reworked it, printed it with Shogakukan sort of more traditionally. And the first volume just came out in English, and it just finished. Third volume just finished in Japan. So first volume's out now. I think there's digital, but if not, there's print. And I'm sure Viz will provide a reader copy for us. But yeah, it's something I want to read myself. And this is the best way to read it, is on the podcast.
All right. Okay. Good.
Oh, and it's a comic about comics. I know we like comics about comics. It's about an editor who gets so fed up with his day job that he quits, and everyone thinks he's going to lose his mind. And he kind of does.
All right. Good picks, everyone. I think the order is going to be The Fable first, because I'm craving something kind of light and fun. We'll slide in Tokyo These Days into second place. And Shortcuts last, only because I want to put it off for as long as possible so we can all get copies.
Thank you, Chip.
All right. And I guess that just leads us with some shout-outs. So make it quick, because I hosted and it went really long. David, go.
My shout-out? Oh,
David,
sorry.
Go. I'm the host, Chris.
Sorry. My shout-out is the page in Daredevil Born Again where Matt and Karen are kind of like hugging after they reconnect. The drawing of the city in the background are just like a bunch of like horizontal lines, and it looks so good. But you might need the black and white edition to tell.
It's beautiful. My goodness. Deb?
My pick is related to our talk about coloring and how comics used to look different in the 80s when it was printed on newsprint. My pick is Hip Hop Family Tree by Ed Pisker.
Okay.
The way that he's drawn this and presented this book, it's on by Fantagraphics, and props to Fantagraphics for committing to printing it this way. But all the flashbacks to the 80s are all drawn in that 80s comic style and colored in that style. It looks like it's on newsprint. And then when there's flashbacks to the present, like when, say, like KRS-One is talking in the present, it has a white underprinting that makes the colors pop in an almost unnatural way.
This is like an Image Comics house style.
Yeah, so that's interesting because Dan Klaus does the same thing.
Oh, in Monica?
Yeah, in Monica, it's all the white is kind of printed in like a gray brownie kind of newsprint look, but he clearly doesn't have that effect. Like the yellows that he uses, like the clearly has like a white knockout, and he just prints the yellow, so it just pops. Like it's really it's a really amazing kind of technique that I keep thinking I should use for something one day. So my shout out is going to just be Daredevil Born Again, because screw it. David picked a page, so I'm just picking the whole.
How about the Artisan Edition?
Yeah, actually, the Artisan Edition. Yeah. Like I've got the Artist Edition, which is just the oversized size as, which is lovely for all the details. So I'd highly recommend picking that up if you're a fan of black and white art. And last but not least, Chris, your shout out.
I checked, and it turns out I was still subscribed to Marvel Unlimited from when I had to explain what Marvel's vertical scrolling comics were last season. I had to subscribe to go in to take screen captures of Ken Nimura's story. So I checked, and I'm still subscribed. So this book didn't cost me anything, but I have been subscribed somehow for 6 months. So his book cost a fortune. And I was like, I'm going to make it work before I cancel it. So I read Ryan North's Fantastic Fours.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They're excellent.
Yeah, really, I'm totally shouting them out. I'm very excited about an upcoming issue that has been finally solicited, because I was talking to Ryan one day, and he was complaining that he didn't know what to do with Franklin Richards. And I'm like, oh, you should do this with Franklin Richards. He's like, can I actually do that? And I was like, it's not up to me. It's up to Tom Brevoort. And he's doing it. So I'm very excited to read that. But I can't jump in at issue 17. That's not cool. So I read the first 13, 14 of those. And yeah, they're great. They're really fun comics that seamlessly blend everything everyone loves about the Fantastic Four with it being a comic written exactly by Ryan North.
Yeah, yeah.
Including the Dinosaur Planet of Dinosaurs, which was pretty fun.
He's so suited for that book. Like when wild, he told me he was going to be doing it, I was just like, oh yeah, that's perfect. That's absolutely perfect.
Yeah, so perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome.
So yeah, Fantastic Four is available now. Remember to unsubscribe when you're done reading.
All right. Well, I guess that's all our shout outs. Thank you all for listening. I know it must have been grueling because it's a Marvel comic and I'm hosting, but I promise you next time we'll have actual manga. So thanks everyone for listening. Bye. This has been Mangasplaining episode 116, Born Again, by Frank Miller and David Mazzucchelli. Thanks for listening. For our next episode, we'll be discussing the manga Guardians of the Louvre by Jiro Taniguchi. Want to pick up a copy? Consider supporting your local comic book and manga specialty shop. Find one near you at comicshoplocator.com, or check out your local library for print and digital lending options. You can also follow along with our complete reading list and show notes at mangasplaining.com, and check out our newsletter and digital publishing endeavor at mangasplainingextra.com. Thanks to DADS for their musical accompaniment this episode.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.